I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Voting is under assault in state houses across the country. In response to Donald Trump's fabricated claims of voter fraud last November, Republican legislators have either passed or proposed more than 250 laws to make voting harder. My guest today is Congressman John Sarbanes, the architect behind H.R. 1, a federal remedy to ensure voting rights, reform campaign finance, and strengthen ethics requirements. The bill passed the House earlier this month. It has the support of 50 senators, but because of the filibuster, Senate rules require a larger majority to pass it in the upper chamber. Today on Midday, the prospects for H.R. 1 and the future of the filibuster. Congressman John Sarbanes joins me after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are with us today. Democrats in the Maryland legislature are proposing an array of bills that will make voting easier and more accessible here in our state. But elsewhere in the country, Republican lawmakers have redoubled efforts to restrict and curtail voting. The Georgia Senate has voted to end no-excuse absentee voting, and they are considering a measure that would prohibit even passing out water and snacks to people who were waiting in line to vote. In Iowa, new laws reduce polling place hours and early voting. In Arizona, lawmakers are considering rules to allow throwing out ballots even if they've arrived before Election Day. The Brennan Center for Justice in New York reports that following historically high voter turnout in the November 2020 elections, more than 250 restrictive bills were making their way through as many as 45 state houses across the country. The bills will place restrictions on mail-in voting and create barriers to casting mail-in ballots. They'll expand voter roll purges, limit opportunities to register to vote, and implement stricter voter ID requirements. Earlier this month, the House passed H.R. 1, called the For the People Act, which would create a federal remedy to these efforts to curtail engagement in the democratic process. The bill calls for sweeping reforms in voting rights, redistricting, campaign finance, and ethics. The Senate is expected to take up a similar bill soon. My guest today is the architect of H.R. 1, Congressman John Sarbanes, who represents Maryland's 3rd District, which includes parts of Baltimore, Howard, Montgomery, and Anne Arundel counties, as well as part of Baltimore City. He joins us from the Capitol. Congressman, welcome back, sir. Good to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's great to be with you today.
So this is kind of deja vu all over again for you and I. We spoke about H.R. 1 in 2019 when you first introduced it. Can you tell us what's different about the 2021 version and the version you originally proposed a couple of years ago?
Well, the newer version of H.R. 1 has some slight changes we made, but I would say on balance, it really represents all of the key reforms that we've assembled and you described in these various baskets: voting reforms, redistricting reform, ethics, campaign finance. We did go in and make a few changes based on the experience voters had in the 2020 election around mail-in voting and some other things that we saw, because we wanted it to be absolutely current. But the good news is that we had already put together a bill that meets the grievances so many Americans have when they look at democracy and feel like they're not included or they're being kind of locked out. Or sort of kept away from their voice being part of their politics and governing. And so while you describe this really threatening campaign that's underway at the state level by GOP lawmakers, more than 250 bills having now been introduced to roll back access to the ballot box, and that's kind of the bad news, the good news is that we're not being caught flat-footed. We have a bill in H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which will be introduced, by the way, today as S1 in the United States Senate. that can meet these threats, that can ensure that people have access to the ballot box, and that all of these other features that should be hallmarks of our democracy can be put in place. So we're glad that we're ready to meet this moment. And now we've just got to make sure we go exercise the will of the public that very much wants to see these changes.
And of course, in 2013, the Supreme Court, in a very controversial decision, gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act. There is a new bill designed to address that decision. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont is the sponsor in the Senate. It's called the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, named after the deceased congressman from Georgia. How does H.R. 1 and its provisions around voting dovetail or compare to the elements that are part of the John Lewis Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, that's a great question. And these two bills, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and what we've designated as H.R. 4 in the House, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, are mutually reinforcing of one another. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act, Advancement Act, is seeking to restore protections that used to be in place before the Shelby decision that you mentioned, to make sure that in places around the country, particularly in the South, where you had states and districts, jurisdictions where there was a historic record of discrimination when it came to voting against people of color, that you had a preclearance process in place where before you could implement any new voting restrictions, they had to be cleared by the United States Justice Department. That was stripped away in 2013. The court said you can go back and refashion this, but we want to see a strong record of evidence that there's still a problem with this in these places. And so the Voting Rights Advancement Act will need to be introduced once there's been a set of hearings that gather up that testimony and evidence from around these places in the country where there's been that discrimination. H.R. 1 is broader in the sense that while it certainly provides these voting reforms to all of these communities that have historically experienced discrimination, it extends them beyond that across the country and would set baseline standards in every state in the U.S. and make sure that people have access, automatic voter registration, same-day registration, convenient mail-in balloting, and other measures that can ensure early voting, for example, that can ensure people have that access. So they really work together. H.R. 1 is in a position, I think, to come out of the gate a little bit earlier because we don't have to go build that special record that the Supreme Court has asked for with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But these work together. And I'll just mention here that John Lewis is a central figure for many reasons in the current narrative. One is it was his state that he represented in the United States Congress for years that delivered the United States Senate to Democrats and gives us the opportunity to pass this legislation. That was the lightning strike of two runoff election wins for Democrats on January 5th. John Lewis's name is attached to the Voting Rights Advancement Act, as you indicated. But John Lewis also wrote the first 300 pages of H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which include all of these key voting reforms. So he remains at the center of this conversation, even after his passing, and I think that's absolutely fitting.
Congressman John Sarbanes is my guest. We're talking about H.R. 1, the For the People Act, passed the House by about a 10-vote margin earlier this month. And as the congressman has just confirmed, it will be introduced in the Senate today as S1. Senator Klobuchar, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, will take up the bill in hearings next Wednesday. Again, we're talking about the For the People Act here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Congressman, when we talked about this a couple of years ago, the bill passed the House. It went to Mitch McConnell, who was at the time the majority leader. Mr. McConnell put it in his desk, and that was the last we heard of it. The situation is different now, as you mentioned, because of those two elections in Georgia in January. It's now a 50-50 split between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. However, when you read press reports about H.R. 1, virtually all of them say it's dead on arrival, it'll hit a buzzsaw in the Senate, it doesn't have a chance of passing. But I've talked to a few folks on the Hill who are much more sanguine. They're much more optimistic about its chances to pass this time around. Obviously, its chances are tied to the filibuster. But generally speaking, what's your level of optimism about this actually being enacted into law?
Tom, I'm very optimistic, and I'll tell you why. I think that this is a moment of opportunity that increasingly members of Congress, certainly in the House where we got this strong vote a couple of weeks ago, and increasingly in the Senate, understand we cannot miss. The state of our democracy is very shaky. We know that. The attack on the Capitol on January 6th put kind of a punctuation mark on that. People want to see the democracy strengthened and revived. And H.R. 1, across all of its measures, whether it's the voting reforms, the ethics, campaign finance, et cetera, is designed to do exactly that. And the plus minus on this has certainly come into focus over the last few weeks. We can either broaden access to political participation and lift the voices of all Americans across the country. That's the vision of H.R. 1, S1. Or we can move backwards in the direction that so many state GOP lawmakers are seeking. So our sense is that H.R. 1 from its beginning, and I've been working on this for many, many years, as you know, the story of its trajectory has been to create new realities along the way, where people start out saying, that'll never happen. It'll never be the first bill you introduce. Well, we got that done. It'll never earn the co-sponsorship of every Democrat in Washington. We did that in 2019. It'll never also be designated as S1 in the United States Senate. That's happening today. So when people say the filibuster is an obstacle that you can't overcome, I just look at the record up to this point in terms of how H.R. 1 has proceeded forward, and I say, we can create a new reality there. And increasingly, Tom, what you're hearing is this notion that if there's one place where a supermajority requirement, procedural requirement, should not be permitted to thwart legislation, it's when that legislation is seeking to restore majority rule in America. This is about fundamental voting rights, political participation, lifting up people's voices and establishing baseline rules for how our democracy operates. That should be a simple up or down majority vote. And I think increasingly that is the perspective you're seeing out there. And I think it's being shared more and more every day by members of the United States Senate.
Yeah, and I want to look more closely at this issue of the filibuster after we take a break. But before we do that, the fundamental argument against H.R. 1 that is being put forth by Republicans is that it is a matter of federal overreach, that the Constitution says that states should control how elections are done, and that this bill would federalize those duties and responsibilities. We should make clear that of all these 250-plus bills that are being considered in state houses across the country, were H.R. 1 to pass, it would supersede all of those local statewide restrictions in voting. So this would trump all of that stuff. How do you answer the argument that the federal government has no business dictating how states run their elections?
There is very clear authority in the Constitution that the Congress has the ability to regulate the time, place, and manner of federal elections. So we have the authority to set these standards across the country. Now, as a practical matter, if you put these protections and standards in place for federal elections, every state is going to also make those the same guidelines and norms for conducting state elections and local elections, because it's not practical or efficient for them to set up two completely systems for administering the vote. So it's the leverage that comes from the authority we have to regulate federal elections that I think will establish these standards across the country. And that's not a federal takeover. That's the federal government and Congress exercising very clear authority, which the Supreme Court has recognized time and again, to regulate, as I say, the time, place, and manner of federal elections across the country. So we think we're on very solid ground. And I'll mention here, if the Republicans were really worried about this federalizing of elections, they probably shouldn't have introduced a bill that would federalize it in the other direction, which is exactly what they've done. They have something called the Save Our Democracy Act, which would put all of these obstacles in place across the country using congressional authority. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and we think that we're on very solid ground with these reforms.
Congressman John Sarbanes, we'll have more with the congressman on the other side of a quick break, and we'll take your calls and comments at that time. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, a conversation with two researchers from the University of Maryland School of Social Work who have written a book about the complex relationship between in-laws. Dr. Jeffrey Greif and Dr. Michael Woolley join me to talk about in-law relationships, mothers, daughters, fathers, and sons. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, my guest is 3rd District Congressman John Sarbanes. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR, and you can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWIPR. So, Congressman, when it comes to the filibuster, there have been a number of suggestions as to how it can be changed, from abandoning the whole thing altogether to chipping away at various customs and provisions. This is a matter for the Senate to take up. This is a matter of Senate procedure and rules, Senate tradition. So you all in the House don't deal with it. But what, when you have conversations with your colleagues in the upper chamber, what are those conversations around when it comes to the filibuster? And as you mentioned, particularly one of the suggestions is to simply make an exception, the way an exception can be made for budget matters. You can get rid of the filibuster. Congressman Clyburn, you and others have said, you know, let's make an exception for things that have to do with voting and with basic democratic endeavors. When you have conversations with senators, what are they asking you about? What's your sense as to the consensus, if there is one, beginning to build about the filibuster?
Well, I think there's an emerging consensus. And you saw actually President Biden speak to this yesterday in this interview he did with George Stephanopoulos, that in its current form, the filibuster is unworkable, and that some change has to be brought to bear. So the fact that that conversation is happening, and that all the Democrats certainly are coming to it ready to think about what that looks like, what those adjustments might be, I think is a very positive and constructive step forward. As you indicate, there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat here. And I don't pretend to be, nor do I really ever want to be, an expert on the Senate rules. But it ranges from eliminating the filibuster completely for all legislative business going forward. I think that's probably a reach, to making specific exceptions for certain kinds of legislation. And that's where you're hearing the argument that when it comes to baseline rules of how the democracy functions, that would be appropriate. To returning to the days, and this is what President Biden talked about yesterday, of requiring members of the Senate to actually stand on the floor and filibuster in the way it was originally envisioned, which requires a lot of stamina and commitment to do. So that's another approach you could take. So I think there's a lot of different ways this could go. What we want to make clear is that certainly this transformational package of democracy reforms is something the public wants to see happen. And if there's that will out there in the country, then there's got to be a way to get it done. Exactly what that looks like, we'll leave to our Senate colleagues to figure it out. But we can't come out of this legislative season and opportunity without these critical reforms in place, or it'll be a disservice to the country at a very, very critical moment for our democracy.
The other side of this, in addition to, you know, changes to the filibuster rule, is changes to H.R. 1, or changes to S.1, as it will be called, in the Senate. Have you had any conversations with folks in either chamber about taking out some of the provisions of H.R. 1? Because this really is a sweeping bit of legislation. This has to do with campaign finance, ethics standards being in place for the Supreme Court and for the president, redistricting, having commissions rather than political entities decide congressional districts, that sort of thing. Is there any discussion about, you know, concentrating on those things that perhaps are more easily palatable to Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, and then fighting some of those other battles on a different day?
For starters, I don't know that there's any changes we would make to this package that would earn Republican support. We went through this exercise, Tom, in 2019 in the House. When we introduced the whole bill as a package, Republicans stood up and said, this is too big. We should just do election security and election infrastructure. So we said, fine. After we passed H.R. 1, we broke those out. One was called the SAFE Act. The other was called the SHIELD Act. We got one Republican vote on the SAFE Act after all that huffing and puffing. So we haven't seen that cooperation. And I think there's an appreciation. Certainly we saw this in the House. I think it's shared by many Democrats in the Senate, that the power of this bill comes from keeping all of its interlocking components together. The reason I say that is we built this from the very early stages based on listening to what the public was asking us for. That was our North Star. And they made it very clear to us that if you just solve one of these issues and challenges and not the others, then you haven't fixed the overall problem. In other words, you make it easier for people to get to the ballot box, but if the representatives they elect get to a Washington that is awash in money and lobbyists and special interest agendas, then they're going to get taken hostage and we're not going to get the policy we want to see. If there's not ethics reforms and transparency and conflict of interest rules in place, members can lose their way. So it's the public that was smart enough to say, it's not just voting you have to fix. You got to make sure there's ethical transparency. You got to make sure that we clean up money in our politics, or else you haven't really lifted our voices up and put us back at the center of our democracy. So I think there's an appreciation, Tom, that this whole package is what we need to reset the rules of the democracy in a way that respects members of the public, everyday Americans, the voters out there. And we're certainly going to lean in to that set of priorities as we move forward. So that's kind of the posture of things now. And I think it's appreciated broadly across the Democratic caucus.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller from Baltimore, Marissa, who's on the line. Marissa, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Congressman. I just wanted to start off by saying that I was really proud of how you, Congressman, just managed and conducted yourself and your office throughout the pandemic and the social justice movement. So thank you for that. And then my question is about how the bill, or if the bill, addresses gerrymandering and ranked choice voting.
Yeah. So thanks for your comments and for the question. The bill includes a fix to partisan gerrymandering. It would require every state in the country to establish an independent redistricting commission. Some states have done that, others have not. It really needs to be a national solution, and that's what we try to achieve in H.R. 1. In addition, just establishing a criteria, independent, fair criteria that those commissions will be required to use when they set about drawing these district maps. So that's an important reform, and it obviously comes at an important time because we're about to embark on the redistricting process that will be in place for the next 10 years. Ranked choice voting is not included in the bill. I view that as what I call sort of next generation reforms. That next generation could come quite quickly, but we wanted to start with a set of reforms that appear to be kind of top of mind for most Americans. And that's kind of how we designed the bill and made decisions on what reform elements to put in it. But certainly ranked choice voting, multi-member districts, electoral college reform, there's a whole set of democracy reforms that are getting increased attention and conversation. And I think you'll continue to see that as we move forward. All of those kinds of reforms, I might add, will be much easier to examine and potentially implement if we get this baseline set of democracy reforms in place that are featured in the For the People Act. I also want to make this point, because I haven't done it yet, Tom. Strong majorities of Republicans, independents, and Democrats support H.R. 1 in polls that have been conducted over the last few weeks. And this is to push back against the critique that you will hear from McConnell and others that somehow this is a Democratic power grab or what have you. No, this is the people of the country trying to grab back their voice in their own democracy. There is no controversy about the reforms that we've put into this bill. The only controversy is that it's taken us this long to make these fixes. That's why the pressure is high for us to get it done at this moment of opportunity and not let that slip by. So that's where our commitment comes. It's the people of the country across the political spectrum that are telling us we want to see these changes.
Senator McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, has said, quote, "It's quite the recipe for rebuilding public faith in our democracy on all sides, a purely partisan effort to seize unprecedented power for Washington, D.C. on a razor-thin majority." As you say, very much like the American Rescue Plan, the COVID-19 stimulus bill that President Biden, Vice President Harris are currently on the road talking about, the support for that starts with the voters and then ends up with folks in the Senate. Let's go back to the phones to Andy, who's calling from Baltimore. He has a question about redistricting reform. Andy, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes.
Hello. Thank you, Tom. Good to speak to you, Congressman. I want to thank you for championing these very important reforms. But I have a question about the implementation of the redistricting. It's my understanding that it's not required until the next census. And so we could be waiting a decade. Is that correct? Or will the Congress be requiring that this be applied by, say, 2024? Thank you.
No. It's meant to apply now. And that's critical here, obviously, because we want to fix this partisan gerrymandering and not have it locked in for another 10 years. So from the very beginning, we saw the opportunity here to get this done in a timely way. What may complicate things is that there's been a delay, as you know, in getting the results of the census. Normally, we would have that data to states by March or April. It's not going to happen until September because of delays that occurred in the prior administration and have spilled over. So the whole process of apportionment, as they call it, and then getting into the redistricting effort is going to be delayed somewhat, and that could make some of the reforms a little trickier to navigate, but we still are confident that we can have in place key criteria to guide how these maps are drawn across the country for this census period and for the 10-year process going forward that will give Americans confidence that this process is fair, it's independent, it's objective, and to use kind of the phrasing you hear, that the voters pick their politicians instead of the other way around. So that was always going to be a key reform.
And moments ago, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer from New York made a speech on the floor of the Senate, and he said, quote, S1, which is the number of this bill in the Senate, S1 is going to be a top priority this Congress. We will fight and fight and fight to get this done. Failure is not an option. Too darn much is at stake. So again, remarks made just a few minutes ago on the floor of the Senate by the current majority leader, Chuck Schumer. My guest is Congressman John Sarbanes. We're going to take a quick break, and we will have more with Representative Sarbanes after that. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Congressman John Sarbanes is my guest until the top of the hour. He is the architect behind H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which the House passed along party lines earlier this month and which will now become S1 in the U.S. Senate. Senator Amy Klobuchar has announced that the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration, which she chairs, will begin hearings on the measure next Wednesday. The bill calls for sweeping reforms to make it easier for eligible Americans to vote, curtails the influence of special interest money in the political process, and it strengthens ethics rules. Republicans oppose it on the grounds that it represents federal overreach, in their view, in matters that should be left to the states. If you have a question for Congressman Sarbanes, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can always tweet us @MiddayWYPR. So, Congressman, as I understand it, all 50 senators have said, 50 Democratic senators say that they support H.R. 1, and all 50 Republicans right now say they do not. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, it's certainly split that way, and it's no surprise given that Mitch McConnell has kind of kept his troops in line, leaning against this over the last two Congresses. Now, you always hold out hope that there will be some Republicans that will join this effort, and I say that emphasizing again that when you talk to people in the country, there's bipartisan support for this. It doesn't break down just along party lines. So if we're listening carefully to what Americans want, you would think we could get that bipartisan support in the Senate. But I just think the Republicans have leaned against these kinds of changes for so long, they can't kind of break out of that mode. And so this is something that is going to have to come out of the Democratic corner.
And the Democrats who support this bill include Senator Manchin from West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, who support the bill but do not support ending the filibuster. So this does come down to the filibuster, because as it stands now in the Senate, the rules say that in order to pass S1, the Senate needs 60 votes in favor of the bill. So if they only have 50, it comes down to the filibuster. Now, Senator Manchin, for example, has expressed some willingness to be open to some of the reforms that you and I mentioned earlier in the show. One of the ones we didn't talk about is a proposal to gradually reduce the number of senators needed to end the filibuster. So it begins with 60 people, and then a few days later, it goes down to 55 people are needed to end the filibuster, and then a few days later, it goes down to 50. And so eventually, it's hoped that under that kind of rule, you know, filibusters would not go on endlessly, and there would be a way for people to get legislation enacted under the margins that are, you know, different margins that are required now. Is the conversation then with Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, does it stay premised in, look, H.R. 1 is really important. Voting rights are really important. Campaign finance is really important. So we got to get rid of the filibuster so that this important piece of legislation will pass. And I wonder how that argument gets made to two senators who appear to say, well, yeah, we support the bill, but we don't support the precedent of changing the supermajority rule in the Senate. How do you reconcile those two sides of that argument?
Well, I think what you recognize for starters is that people like Senator Manchin have indicated just in the last 2 weeks a willingness to consider different versions of the filibuster. And that's a change. I mean, what he talks about is he wants to make sure that the voice of the minority in the Senate is heard. Well, there are a lot of different ways you can achieve that. And the conversation is happening around sort of three or four permutations of the filibuster that would allow the minority's voice to be fully heard in that chamber, but would not end up blocking critical legislation, particularly legislation that's as fundamental as these democracy reforms. So I think this comes back to kind of the inexorable quality of this package in terms of what it contains, how it represents the desires and broad appetite of the American people, and how there's a recognition that a procedural rule, which I might add, President Obama has referred to as a Jim Crow relic, the filibuster, that a procedural rule should not be allowed to be used to frustrate fundamental democracy reform. This is about voting rights. It's about civil rights. It's about, if you look at the voting reforms, Tom, it's about making sure we can ensure diversity of participation on the part of voters. That's what these reforms can make sure happens. But if you look at the campaign finance reforms and setting up like a small donor matching system to fund congressional campaigns, that's about ensuring diversity of participation as candidates in our democracy. You can have all these voters showing up and have broad access, but if the candidate pool that they're choosing from is still overwhelmingly male and white, you haven't really broadened that kind of access to the democracy. What we've seen when you put these systems, these small donor matching systems in place across the country, including in certain jurisdictions in Maryland, is that the racial, gender, socioeconomic diversity of the candidate pool increases significantly because people can run and compete and resource their campaign, even if they don't know deep-pocketed donors or get, you know, contributions from PACs and special interests. That's another way of opening up our democracy. So all of these things work together in a way that meets the appetite of the public. And I think on the Senate side, when it comes to the filibuster potentially blocking this, you're going to have the will of the, what I would say is the sort of unstoppable force of the American people's will and appetite for this, overcoming whatever the immovable objects might be, procedural or otherwise, in the United States Senate, so we can get this done. We can't miss this opportunity, and I think increasingly that appreciation is settling in across all quarters.
Let's go back to the phones to Joyce, who's on the line from Nottingham. Joyce, welcome to Midday with Congressman Sarbanes.
Hi, Congressman Sarbanes. How are you?
Very well.
I just have a quick question. I hope you can help. I just want to know what I can do as a citizen voter to help get these bills passed. Is there writing, right, calling, whatever it will take?
Well, all of the above, Joyce. Thank you for that. I would encourage you to go to the Declaration for American Democracy. If you look that up on the internet, that is a coalition of over 150 labor groups, environmental groups, good government, gun safety groups, faith groups, and so forth, who've come together, who've linked arms, because they realize that all of the things that they're working for, the progress they want to see on those issues that matter so much to Americans, is being blocked oftentimes by the influence of big money, by the way the system has been rigged at the ballot box, and so forth. And so they've made H.R. 1, S.1, the For the People Act, a priority. And there's some good opportunities listed there to connect to that coalition and to some of the groups, Common Cause and others, that are doing great work out there to advance the bill. So I appreciate your interest in helping. And again, I'd encourage you to go to the website of the Declaration for American Democracy.
And Joyce's comment echoes an email we got from Maureen in Towson, who asks, you know, how can we reach those who are making decisions that affect all Americans but who represent other states or districts? And then David in Towson invokes LBJ, and his question for you, Congressman, is how do you see the president and the vice president using their relationships with members of the Senate to bring in the votes necessary to pass the bill? And he, as I mentioned, cited LBJ and his efforts to strong-arm folks to get the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act passed in 64 and 65. But do you anticipate really aggressive, strong support for this measure from President Biden and Vice President Harris?
We're already seeing that, Tom. Before we had the House vote 2 weeks ago on H.R. 1, the administration issued what they call a statement of administration policy, which was an endorsement of the bill. After the bill was passed, President Biden issued a very, very strong statement indicating he's ready to sign it when it comes to his desk. His comments last night about the filibuster and the need to reexamine it and make some adjustments, I think, was a recognition that it can't be used to stop critical legislation like H.R. 1. So there's obviously a lot of power that can come from the bully pulpit of the presidency. And we've been very gratified over the last few weeks with President Biden stepping in behind this. I will point out to you that, and to the listeners, if you go back to 1973, a newly minted Senator Joe Biden was testifying in April of that year in front of the relevant committee on why he felt we needed public financing of campaigns in America, because he said that the influence of big money and special interests on our democracy at that time was insidious and was distorting public policy. That was 50 years ago. We know that today the money crowd operates on steroids compared to what it was back then. So the need for these changes have only increased over that period of time. And in the White House, you have one of the original reformers. So I think that that can define how President Biden relates to this transformational effort to bring our democracy up to the gold standard we know it should have.
The great political philosopher Donald Trump said last year on the record that if we continue to have a lot of people voting and voting access gets broader, then Republicans will never win again. So it's assumed that one of the reasons that Republicans oppose this measure and that one of the reasons that they are proposing so many other measures to restrict voting is that they think the more people who vote, the more chance they'll have of losing. How do you respond to that argument that this is, again, in Senator McConnell's words, you know, a partisan play to consolidate power?
I think that's very short-sighted. In fact, I think that this legislation could help restore a responsible and rational Republican Party out there. Because the fact of the matter is, if you win elections based on shrinking the political town square, on kind of limiting the size and makeup of the audience you're responsible to through voter suppression, through partisan gerrymandering, through using big money to spread disinformation, it makes it easier for extreme voices within your own political ecosystem inside your party to get traction. We've seen that over the last few years. But if you're more broadly accountable to a diverse electorate that's showing up every 2 years, you're going to have to retrench and figure out a way to go win hearts and minds based on your ideas and the strength of your public policy proposals. That would be good for the Republican Party, and it would give them an incentive to kind of flush out these extreme voices that have come into their party and I think really distorted it. So we think there should be two strong political parties in America, that they should go win based on their ideas, and that having a healthy democracy in the ways we're trying to achieve would advance that. Unfortunately, Republicans are reaching for the convenient playbook they've been conditioned to use over the last few years. That's what you're seeing happen across the country. But in the long run, that's not going to save their party. What would save their party is to step up and make American democracy strong again. And I think they could do very well under those conditions. So again, this is not a partisan thing. This is about restoring our democracy so people of all political stripes have access, their voices can be heard, and their policies can be debated in the places where laws are made.
Yeah, and keep in mind, the Democrats did win the White House and barely won the Senate, but in Congress, in a high turnout election, Republicans picked up seats in the House of Representatives. So it's certainly by no means a sure thing that higher voter turnout means Democrat wins. Congressman John Sarbanes represents the 3rd District here in Maryland. Congressman, thank you for your time. I appreciate it, and good luck and Godspeed. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thanks very much, Tom. Take care.
That's it for us today. On the way tomorrow, a conversation about the complexities of relationships between in-laws. My guests are 2 professors at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, Jeffrey Greif and Michael Woolley. We'll talk about their latest book. It's called In-Law Relationships: Mothers, Daughters, Fathers, and Sons. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, and later today, download The Daily Dose. That's WYPR's compendium of local news with Aaron Henkin, as well as the Chesapeake Connect podcast. That's a pod that I host in which we discuss issues of regionalism with leaders throughout the Baltimore metropolitan area. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Stay safe.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.